2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Welcome. This is Religion Today. I'm your host, Martin Tanner. Today, I approach a subject which causes strong feelings among many people. I've had some emails and questions about it recently, so I thought it might be a good idea to give some context to the subject of polygamy. There are a lot of different people who look with a microscope at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in its brief actual history with polygamy, but they don't talk about any other contexts of polygamy, which are very, very relevant. So today, I'm going to talk about polygamy in the Bible in the Old Testament, polygamy in the New Testament era, also polygamy in Judaism and Christianity in New Testament times and after, a little bit about the history of polygamy in the LDS Church, which was formally abolished in 1890, and about how, despite it's almost never mentioned, polygamy exists today, right now, in a number of other Christian denominations. So with that short little teaser and background, in the Old Testament, there are at least 40 men who are described as having had more than one wife. Among those are, of course, Abraham, Esau, Ezra, Gideon, Hosea, Jacob, Manasseh, Moses, Rehoboam, Saul, Terah, Zedekiah, and, of course, David and Solomon. Abraham is sometimes overlooked in this whole discussion. The Midrash about Abraham and his three wives, and yes, there were three, has kind of a fascinating observation. It says that Abraham was married to Sarah, who was the daughter of Shem. He was married to Keturah, who was the daughter of Japheth, and he was married to Hagar, who was the daughter of Ham. So Abraham married and had children with all three of the families who are descendants of Noah, which I find fascinating. The Bible also mentions in the Old Testament polygamy in Exodus chapter 21, verse 10, which says, quote, "If a man take another wife for himself, her food, her clothing, her duty of marriage," referring to the first wife, "shall not diminish," close quote. Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 15 through 17 says that if a man has another wife, the inheritance still goes to the firstborn son of the first wife. And it even goes into comments about even if he doesn't like the mother of that son, indicating that then as now, this was not always a harmonious institution of marriage. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 17, also admonishes that the king is not to have too many wives in early Judaism. One of the most important places that polygamy is overlooked is during the time of Christ and thereafter. Josephus, the great Jewish historian who wrote about Judaism during the time of Christianity, or at least the beginnings of Christianity and slightly before, talks about polygamy in two specific places. And we also read about it amongst the writings of Justin Martyr, who was an early Christian church father. In 2012, he had a debate with Trypho, who was a Jewish scholar. And in those discussions, Justin Martyr talks about the Jews then permitting polygamy. So even as late as 2012 AD, the Jews were continuing to practice polygamy. And it was also apparently occasionally found amongst Christians. We have statements in 285 of a constitution that was made about polygamy in the Roman Empire. And during that time, it specifically stated that polygamy was not allowed, but there was an exception that was made for Christians and Jews. St. Augustine, the great Christian church father, mentioned in the 4th century, actually the second half of the 4th century, that marriage was very important, and he believed that it was better promoted by a husband having just one wife than several wives, which clearly indicates that there were a number of people during that time period in Christianity being married to more than one wife. There's a fascinating reference in the 5th century that the Roman Emperor Vatican I had two wives, and he was supported by that according to the Christian faith at the time. Another statement in the Middle Ages dealing with Christianity is also a fascinating one. There was, at kind of a local level, in Lotharingia, which is present-day France, where a Christian had a wife and then decided, for reasons that are unimportant here, that he was going to marry a second wife. The Pope, or the local bishops, told him no, he had to divorce his first wife to do that or have the marriage annulled. And then the Pope voided that decision and made him take back his first wife, so he had two wives. There was, in 1120 through 1188, a number of edicts in the Norwegian Christian church which said that concubines were not allowed the sacraments, but if they were married to their man, who would then become their husband, then, of course, they could take the sacrament, according to these edicts. Fascinatingly enough, clear into the time of the Reformation, there are references to polygamy within Christianity. Martin Luther, the great reformist, said this, quote, "I confess that I cannot forbid a person to marry several wives, for it does not contradict the scripture. If a man wishes to marry more than one wife, he should be asked whether he is satisfied in his conscience that he may do so in accordance with the word of God. In such a case, the civil authority has nothing to do in the matter." There are a number of other indications that there was polygamy in the Christian faith clear into the 16th century. There was a Capuchin monk named Bernardino Ochino who wrote 30 dialogues, which were quite important in the Catholic faith at the time. Dialogue 21 is a defense of plural marriage. It's fascinating that today, while no member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints can enter into plural marriage under any circumstances, that men from the Middle East and Africa who have more than one wife who convert to Christianity may convert and keep all of their wives. In the Lutheran faith, in the Presbyterian faith, and in the Baptist faith. So hence, ironically, although it's almost never mentioned, we live in an age where in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, no plural marriage. But in the Lutheran, Presbyterian, Baptist, and other branches of Christianity, under some limited, very limited circumstances, it can be found. When we come back on the other side of this break, more information about the context of polygamy, which I hope will be useful. Stay tuned. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today. We're back. This is Religion Today. I'm your host, Martin Tanner. Today we're talking about polygamy in the Old Testament, in the New Testament periods thereafter in Christianity, and about how it's actually practiced in limited circumstances in some Christian churches today, but not in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I would be remiss if I didn't mention a couple of brief things about Joseph Smith and allegations of polygamy during his time. What was happening during the time period of Joseph Smith is often referred to as polygamy, but I think it's more accurately described as ceilings for eternity. During Joseph Smith's era and later, it was thought to be very appropriate to be sealed into the families for the eternities of a church leader, Joseph Smith, or any one of a number of early LDS church leaders. And as a result of that, a number of women requested that they be sealed to Joseph Smith. And these often are not quite accurately described. One of the points to be made here is that although Joseph Smith had a number of children with his wife Emma, despite allegations that he had children with other women, DNA tests disprove that. There have been a number of claims, and Ugo Pedergo, who's an LDS geneticist, and world-renowned geneticist, has proven that today no one who claims that they are a child of Joseph Smith outside of being a descendant of he and Emma, none of those allegations are true. So Joseph Smith was sealed, apparently, to these women. One of the allegations that sometimes comes up about Joseph Smith is that he married very young girls. One that's frequently brought up is Fanny Alger, who was 14 years old at the time. The rest of the facts that are often never mentioned are that Joseph Smith was sealed for eternity to Fanny Alger with Fanny Alger's parents' consent. And her father was actually present at the ceremony. After the sealing, Fanny Alger went back home with her father. Later, and of course this sealing, as I mentioned, but I'm going to reemphasize it, this sealing was for eternity only. Later, Fanny Alger moved back to New York, found and married a young man about her age, and they had six kids. Why would Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger be sealed? Why would Fanny Alger think this was a good idea? She wanted to bind her family with Joseph Smith's family in the next life. It was as simple as that. There are some claims by Oliver Cowdery that Joseph Smith's relationship with Fanny Alger was more specific than what I've just outlined, but Oliver Cowdery was actually excommunicated over those allegations because he admitted that Joseph Smith did not have an affair with Fanny Alger. There are other claims about Joseph Smith being sealed or married to other people, including other men's wives, and they, in every case, turn out to be circumstances where he was sealed to someone who had a husband who was not a member of the church, and they wanted to be involved in the family of Joseph Smith, the broader family of Joseph Smith in the next life. That's the main circumstance. Let's talk briefly about polygamy in Utah after 1847, after the church moved to the Utah Territory. There, things changed dramatically. Brigham Young, of course, did practice polygamy and had many, many children with a number of different wives. This was done during a very short period of time, and it ended very specifically in 1890. Of course, there are allegations that it continued on, but that was not done with authorization or with authority. These sealings were very different from the kinds of, how shall I say it, fundamentalist relationships that happen today with the Kingstons and a number of other people. Why? Because they were voluntary. The ones today amongst different so-called fundamentalist sects are not. They're arranged marriages, often very much against what is desired by the young lady who's involved. Keep in mind that women in Utah found the, surprisingly enough to many, but this is really true, found the institution of plural marriage to be highly liberating. Someone might ask why. The answer is that Utah gave women the right to vote first of every state in the United States. And then what happened was that women who were part of a plural marriage had a wife who they trusted to take care of their children. This allowed Utah to have the very first women legislators. And many of the early Latter-day Saint women were highly educated and became doctors and lawyers and professors and teachers. And they had some outstanding careers. There's one very notable case where a wife ran for state office and beat her husband, who was the opponent. Fascinating circumstances. One of the most interesting contexts that ought to be brought up here is that Susan B. Anthony, who gets the credit, even on a gold dollar, for being so involved with women's rights in the United States, would acknowledge and state that she got much of her information and much of her inspiration from Latter-day Saint women. Before she was a suffragette back east, and way before she got women the right to vote back east in New York, she came out and visited the Relief Society presidency. And many of the early members of the Relief Society helped her understand how they had obtained the right to vote, and about plural marriage, and about how it had allowed many of the women of Utah to go back to school and to become highly educated and to be teachers and lawyers and doctors and legislators. The Utah legislature had a number of Latter-day Saint women who were deeply involved in politics. There are those who say one was called to be involved in polygamy. That's a little too simplistic. It's a little bit like callings today. Communication back and forth if someone wants to go on a mission or is involved in a calling. I hope these comments help. If you have a question about it, feel free to send me an email, demartinstanner@gmail.com. I'll be happy to respond. Join me again next week.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas,
in the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.